This is what keeps me from having to be alone with my thoughts.
Yeah, because that's the worst.
You are listening to True Crime Fiction, feeding your addiction to the best of the written and the spoken word in crime. If you would like to support the podcast, you can do so for as little as £1 at patreon.com/truecrimefiction.
Hello, listeners. Today on the podcast, we are interviewing Amy Suter Clark, and her debut novel, Girl 11, has been out in the UK in paperback for a few weeks. It's about to come in the US in paperback in August, and you can already buy it in all good bookshops, including the True Crime Fiction bookshop. I'll put a link in the show notes for anyone who wants to go there and buy the book after they've listened. And Girl 11 is a really intriguing piece of crime fiction, I think. Amy, hello, welcome.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. Would you like to tell the listeners a little bit about what's going on in Girl 11, just to give them a wee taste?
Sure. Girl 11 features Elle Castillo. She is a true crime podcast host, and she specializes in investigating cold cases of crimes against children in Minnesota, which is where I'm from, in the Midwest of the United States, up towards Canada, for those who don't know. And her podcast has gone from strength to strength over the past few years. She's had some successful solves on her investigations. And so she decides she's going to tackle the white whale, which is the countdown killer, who was a notorious serial killer 20 years past in Minnesota, who was never caught. And his victims were each a year younger than the last, until he stopped with his 11-year-old victim abruptly and was never seen again. And she's determined to find out who he was. She's convinced he's still alive and that she can bring him to justice.
So you were a podcaster yourself before. So how much was your experience of podcasting tied up in the inspiration and writing this book?
I actually started my podcast, which was called, is called Scared Litless, after I wrote Girl 11. I was wanting to kind of find a way of talking about not just my book, but my love for crime and thriller fiction and true crime, podcast media of all kinds, in a platform that was a little bit different from an author newsletter, which is pretty standard for a lot of authors these days to have an email list. And I just never felt like I was much good at that. And I loved podcasts, and obviously my book featured a podcast as like a main conceit. So it made sense as a thing to do. So I did 5 episodes, and it's currently on hiatus. As many people who have followed me on social media for a while will know, I have 7-month-old twins, and that kind of threw a wrench in a lot of things in terms of my author and podcasting life. But it is something I do hope to get back to. It was a great avenue for interviewing other thriller authors and talking about their books and talking about all things crime.
Yeah, having a baby does often stop you being able to do these things. I think one of the reasons I've been able to do the podcast is because my daughter is now a lot older and doesn't need me quite so much. But I could not have contemplated doing this, I think, when she was a lot younger. So you're a long time podcast lover, and it's quite exciting for me to find somebody who enjoys crime podcasts as much as crime books, because one of the things I find is that there seems to be a bit of division in crime, and you'll get a lot of people like, oh no, I could never read true crime. Or you'll get people like, oh, I don't like the fiction, I like the real stuff. And it almost feels as though people feel like they have to choose a side, and I don't think you have to, because they all feed
no.
Brother. Have you discovered that yourself?
I think, yeah, I guess I don't think I've met people who are only one way or the other, like hardline, but I think there are a lot of people who have a preference. Interestingly, I have a preference for fiction in books, but a preference for true crime in podcasts. So I'd rather listen to a true crime investigation than some kind of radio theater or even an audiobook of a fiction thriller. I think I would prefer to listen to a true crime in that respect.
So what was the podcast that got you really into true crime podcasting? I find everybody always has one where they were like, I listened to this and then I was hooked and that's it.
It's so cheesy, or not cheesy, but it's so common that Serial was the reason that I started listening to podcasts, period. Like I didn't even know about podcasts as a thing that existed before Serial. But I think, so I have to give that credit, obviously, because I got into podcasts because of that. But I think the thing that really kept me like hungrily looking for new podcasts was Someone Knows Something. It's David Ridgeon. It's a Canadian Broadcasting Company podcast, which they do. CBC does incredible podcasts all around. Like everyone I've heard is so well done. But he looks into super cold cases. I think the first one he investigates was the disappearance, like 40-year-old disappearance of a child in the woods. Like he just vanished. And so he was looking into whether he was kidnapped or if he, you know, fell or drowned or something, and they just were never able to find his body.
Yeah, is that the one when they bring out the dogs, the sniffer dogs?
Yes.
Yeah. I remember listening to that one, and it was one which emotionally tugged at you. Sometimes you can listen and you don't really feel a connection, but I think with that one they did, and there was a part of me that was hoping those dogs would find something, because you know, the thought of the parents and the family just being left with nothing at all. So yeah, that one was very well done. And I think when podcasts, particularly true crime, are very well done, they kind of can really open up something bigger. You know, it's not just about the crime, it's about the way the crime has impacted on people, the way it impacts on communities, what it tells us about ourselves and how we react as society to that crime. And I think in Girl 11, Elle is that kind of podcaster. She's very considered. She thinks a lot about the ethics of what she's doing, but there are times when she may be a bit over emotionally involved as well, and that might cloud her judgment a little bit. So how much when you were writing Elle, were you thinking about all those ethics that goes behind true crime podcasting? Because I think of all the genres, and I'm willing to be wrong on this, but at the moment, I'd say I think of all the genres, true crime is one of the genres which has to think about ethics the most.
Yeah, I think I thought about it a lot while I was writing Elle's perspective. And I think one of the things Elle sort of works out, and this isn't really a spoiler, but one of the things that she sort of works out is that she thinks she's better than she really is at being, you know, this ultra ethical true crime podcast host. And it's sort of, I don't really pose this question, but it sort of begs the question, like, is that even possible when you're literally making money off of telling the stories of the worst things that have ever happened to a family? Even if that family has given you their blessing to tell their story, is it still ethical? And it's really hard to do something like that without slipping into being exploitative, especially when you realize that you're going to get more listeners if you tip the line a little bit more into the dramatic or, you know, the salacious details and that sort of thing, instead of just sticking in that hard line just for the sake of ethics. In terms of which genre has the most requirement for that, I think anything specifically dealing with nonfiction has a really major obligation to be ethical in their storytelling. Obviously, anything to do with journalism and that kind of reporting certainly does, and has a pretty high, or should have a pretty high, ethical bar. But definitely true crime. I mean, when I listen to true crime podcasts, I listen to journalists and, you know, true crime authors all the time talking about the things that they struggle with when they're reporting. And just today I was listening to Kate Winkler Dawson, hosts a podcast called Tenfold More Wicked. And she has kind of a spinoff on that channel called Wicked Words. And she interviews authors and journalists about what they, you know, the crimes and the cases that they cover. And she's pointed out to one of the men that she was interviewing that you're the first male and sometimes even female reporter that I've read that never mentions whether a woman is beautiful when you're talking about that she's a victim. And I just thought, that's so true. Like, I've never even thought about it, because it doesn't seem like a bad thing to say, but it's also very irrelevant. Like, when a woman has lost her life, to mention that she's beautiful doesn't make you a more empathetic reporter. It just makes, you know, it's just a description. It's as if it's more sad because she was beautiful.
It's like there's a greater value somehow.
Right.
Because I think a lot of people are at pains now to focus a bit more on the victim than the killer, because we've realized that kind of aggrandizing killers in a way helps killers, because that's what they want. They want the attention. And I don't think any of us really want to give them what they want. But people have moved a bit more to focusing on the victim and who they are. And there are a few phrases that always come up. I was just listening to a podcast last night where it came up again, and they were like, oh, when she walked into a room, she lit it up. And I was just thinking, you know what? You're much safer if you're just a grumpy bastard, because everybody gets killed, lights up a room. You know,
exactly. Exactly. Oh, she was the nicest person. She never had a bad thing to say about anyone. It's like, yeah, I knew it was right for me to be a gossipy old bitch. Like, no one will kill me now.
And it is interesting, because it's sort of that kind of feeds into other discussions that are happening in true crime, but also sort of in wider society, particularly around female victims. And I remember this was quite big during Game of Thrones, when they had a particular scene where, I'm hoping this isn't going to be a spoiler for anybody, but move
not
on
at 30 this seconds. Point.
And don't watch season 8. But when Jaime rapes Cersei, I remember that being a really big thing, and Jezebel coming out and saying, we're not going to watch Game of Thrones anymore, because it wasn't in the book. It didn't do anything to move on the plot. It didn't do anything to tell us about the characters. It was just there for a rape scene, and rape being used as a kind of plot device rather than a very considered action, which is there for a very specific and needed purpose in writing. So I kind of feel like that links in somehow to that discussion as well, about why are the victims always beautiful, why do they always light up a room, what about the undeserving victims? You know, there's people who get murdered who I'm sure are not that nice, but do they deserve less attention just because they weren't always happy?
And then you have, you know, victims who were sex workers or otherwise marginalized, and, you know, literally, at least in the States, like, you have police forces using the acronym NHI, which is no human involved, reporting on a body being found or that kind of thing. Sort of notorious for that, especially when it's a Black person or a sex worker. Happens, I don't know. I can't say I know for sure that it still happens, but it's definitely been reported on and happened in many cities.
So this is completely new to me. I have never heard this before.
I've done a lot of research into police corruption and police violence for different projects that I've worked on. But I don't want to provide misinformation. So I will just say, just look up the term no human involved police, and you'll definitely be able to find information about that.
Okay, because that to me immediately sounds quite chilling, because if there's a human body there, then obviously a human was involved.
Exactly.
I don't know if that's just like a really poor use of communication when they mean an accidental death, i.e. no human actually killed this human, but even if it is a miscommunication, it's a very, very poor choice of words and very dehumanizing. There's I don't know if you'll have listened to this podcast. I really rate Canadian podcasts. They're really good. Thunder Bay is really amazing, because
I'll have to check it out.
It's this small, well, small, largish town. When people in America and Canada say small town, That always freaks me out because I grew up in a village of 150 people and I'm like, that's a small town. Whereas when you guys are talking small town, you're talking like, oh, it's only a million. I'm like, that's not small.
Yeah. I say I'm from a small town and it was about 13,000 people. But I'm also, you know, I'm keenly aware that there were very small towns all around me, you know, yeah. with that more, you know, 150 to 300 people kind of population.
Yeah, so Thunder Bay is in Ontario, I think. And for decades, they've had Indigenous teens turning up dead, quite often near water, but it is on the coast, so there's a lot of water. And they started looking into this. And of course, your first thought is serial killer, the same type of victim. Often found in the same way. That's what it looks like. But they actually pull out and they look at the whole of Thunder Bay and the history of Thunder Bay's relationship to Indigenous people. And it's not a serial killer. It's racism, which is killing these teens. And not just killing them, but making sure nobody's ever brought to
the biggest serial killer of them all, racism.
Absolutely. And I just thought it was such a wonderful way to shine a light on that issue, to use true crime, because there's a lot of flexibility in crime. I think a lot of people kind of think, oh, it's just all about serial killers. But I think there's a lot of flexibility to talk about much wider societal issues. And that's one of the things that's really interesting about crime and keeps me really engaged in crime. And I thought Thunder Bay was just an amazing example of that. So I'd highly recommend.
Great. Thank you. I'm always on the lookout.
Yeah, it's good. And I also, I really hated On the Farm by Stevie Cameron, but it was very well done, but I just hated it because it's about Willie Pickham and there's nothing good about reading about him. But again, Stevie Cameron did a wonderful job on focusing on the sex workers and painting their lives as fully human, you know, more than just a sex worker, you know, somebody who's lived a whole life, who has a family, who has people who care about them and what happens to them. So, and that's Canada again. So that was another really good example, I thought, of kind of really making that effort to humanize victims that society often finds very easy to overlook. So with the Countdown Killer, one of the things that stood out for me was, we all know serial killers have signatures, and those signatures are very personal to the psychology. But one of the things that stood out for me was that he has a very complex signature, and there's a very complex kind of relationship with very specific numbers that he has, which is very deeply rooted in his psyche. I think if I had been writing a character with that sort of level of complexity of signature, I'd be a little bit in trepidation of writing it and maybe getting it wrong. And so, was the plotting really difficult to plot out all the times, all the dates? Did you have like a big murder wall? How did you do that?
I didn't have a wall, but I did have a pretty big detailed outline, not before I wrote it, but after I wrote it. And once I was trying to make sure everything was consistent and all that, I had to, you know, because there's a specific number of days that he keeps each victim and all that stuff. So I needed to make sure I was keeping track of everything correctly that way. And, you know, writing in a scene, I say something about last Friday, and then I had to make sure, has it been 4 days since Friday, and what day is it now? And that sort of thing was incredibly complicated as well. I definitely went through multiple iterations of this killer, in terms of, he always killed victims who were a year younger than the last. That was the original idea that I had for him and for this book. But why he did it, how he did it, you know, how he treated his victims while he held them captive, all of that kind of shifted around a little bit. I knew that I didn't want him to be one of those horrific, you know, people who's torturing his victims for a week and that sort of thing. I think that those stories have been told enough, and particularly when you're making it up, like, it just feels like I'm just making up the worst possible thing I can think of, and that's just awful. And I thought it would be more interesting to have him, you know, holding these victims captive, but for a specific reason that went beyond just sexual gratification due to torture. So thinking about what would lead him to do that and what, you know, the way he would treat his victims when he had them, that to me was actually more chilling.
Yeah.
Coming up with those reasons and that backstory.
I find the idea that he went for somebody a year younger every time actually one of the most sinister parts of it, because I feel like as a parent, if I lived there, I would be in fear that he would get to my daughter's age. And then what do you do? Do you keep your child indoors until the next person is a victim? Like, that feels horrible as well. And I think that kind of count, because you're like, how far down is he going to go?
Exactly.
What age is he actually going to stop at? And I felt that kind of sense of the unknown, but the ticking clock as well added a real level of sinisterness to the countdown killer. Also, I think there was just a strange sense of time in the book as well. So you go forward and you backwards. There's quite a few flashbacks. But also, Elle often works through the night, which is not something I can ever do. So sometimes I'm like, what day are we on? And does she needs to go to bed. She needs to get a good night. She's not looking after herself.
I got very tired on behalf of Elle when I was writing her. But then I just kept being like, would she just go to bed when her, like, Arisat's daughter is missing? Like, would you even be able to sleep until you absolutely just crashed? You know what I mean? Like, I don't have a daughter still, but at the time I didn't have children at all. So I was just going based on, like, what I would imagine how you would feel as someone who basically feels like a mother or a mother figure. You know, the closest I came at the time was being an aunt. And I just thought, if one of my nieces or nephews had been kidnapped and I felt like I had the means to bring them home, like, the last thing on my mind would be getting a night of rest.
That's absolutely true. I think you're right about that. I just know I'm not somebody who...
Yeah, exactly.
I need more sleep than the average person on a good day. So that life wouldn't work. I could not be a detective, because I'd be like, no, it's 9 o'clock, I'm going to bed, good night.
Yeah.
We'll start solving again tomorrow at 7. And everyone would hate me. One of the things that Girl 11 really got me thinking about was the sort of the character pantheon of crime fiction, because we have some people who've sort of stock characters who've been around for a long time, like the Private Eye, who sometimes could be a kind of like Raymond Chandler hard-boiled type, or it could be like an Agatha Christie eccentric type, or we have the police detective, which I think is always a very interesting one, because they can be so incredibly varied and there's so many different types of police person in crime fiction. But the podcaster feels to me like something new in crime fiction, and it's obviously art following life. Do you think we might be at the beginning of seeing a new sort of stock character for crime fiction, or even a new sort of subgenre?
I think you could argue, yeah, that we already have it, because certainly Girl 11 has sort of been compared to Sadie by Courtney Summers, or The Night Swim by Megan Golden. You know, there's the series on Apple TV Plus, Truth Be Told, which is based on, I can't remember the original title suddenly of the book that it's based on, but now I think the book has been retitled to be Truth Be Told to coincide with that TV series. But all of those surround podcast hosts. I know there was another book that came out in my debut year called If I Disappear, which was about a woman who tried to solve the disappearance of her favorite podcast host, which was an interesting play on it, and a really interesting book. So yeah, I think that there's certainly aspects of true crime podcasts that have found their way into dozens of thrillers and crime novels by now, but it does still feel very niche. Whereas I feel like what you're talking about are, you know, archetypes that have stood the test of time. And I would be surprised, I suppose, if the true crime podcast host became that kind of character archetype, because it almost feels like a TV host of a, you know, true crime, something like Dateline or something like that, becoming a character archetype, because I'm sure there have been several of those types of books written as well. But I don't know. I could be wrong. I mean, podcasts, you know, Serial came out, I think, in 2014.
Yeah.
So that's 8 years ago. And there certainly have been many books since then that have used that type of character as a main character. So it'll be interesting to see how long it sticks around.
I think it will be, because I feel like podcasting is still somewhat in its infancy. Mm. I listen to podcasts all the time. And I think when you're into podcasts, you're almost very surprised when people don't listen to podcasts.
Yeah,
like,
it's true.
What do you listen to?
What do you do when you're cooking?
I know. This is what makes me be able to do housework. If it wasn't,
it's so true.
Any housework done, because it's just too boring otherwise.
This is what keeps me from having to be alone with my thoughts.
Yeah, because that's the worst.
It's awful. Actually, I will say, I think that listening to podcasts, as much as I love them and I've credited, you know, them for inspiration for books and things like that and research, I think it has harmed me a little bit on my writer brain, because as a writer, you really need that mental space to sort of subconsciously untangle things with your book. And when you're constantly having someone's voice in your ear, it's kind of hard to do that. So I have to force myself, you know, to maybe not take a walk without my earbuds, you know, just to think about my book, or not think about my book, but, you know, just walk and be alone with my thoughts, as I said, which can be tricky, but is really essential sometimes.
Yeah, that's very interesting, actually, to hear, because I think podcast fans tend to be very, very dedicated people to podcasts in general. So it's really interesting to hear a podcast fan go, oh, maybe there is a bit of a downside. But it's like everything. If you binge too much, it's too much. Yeah.
Moderation.
So, yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I'm not sure the rest of the world is necessarily caught up with the podcast in the way, you know, podcast fans have. I have one friend who only ever reads the blog. She won't listen to it. She just hates listening to audio. So it's not for everybody. But I did think it'll be interesting to see, because there's not the same kind of gatekeeping with podcasting as there would be if, say, you were presenting a show on TV. There isn't, you know, you don't have the same kind of backup and crew. It's much more sort of one lone person or maybe a couple of people working on a podcast, and literally anybody can start one. So I kind of thought, it feels to me like there's a lot more to mine in crime fiction in the podcast. So do you think you might carry this on into future books, or are you like, no, I've done what I wanted to with L, I'm going to move on to something else?
I think if I was to do another podcast-ish book, it would be a sequel with featuring L again, or some kind of companion novel where a main character listens to L's podcast, for example. So it wouldn't be a totally new podcast or a totally new host.
Yeah, that makes sense. So you kind of have a stream of continuity possibly going through it.
I definitely think L has further stories that could be explored, but I don't have any specific ideas at this point. So I haven't started working on anything.
Yeah. When I got to the end, I did kind of feel like it doesn't feel like that's the end of L for me. Like, I couldn't quite put my finger on why, but I was like, it feels like there's maybe some more here. So it will be interesting to see what you might do with her in the future. So obviously at the moment, your hands are very full with your twins. Are you getting any writing time in at all? Is there anything you're working on that you could tell us about?
Yes. Finally, I think a switch kind of flipped. I don't know if it's because it became April and my book is due in May or what it is, but I am finally near the end of redrafting my second book. So for some reason, I need to fully write a book and get it wrong in order to actually write it properly. This has happened many times. It happened with Girl 11, and it's happened with this one now too, where I wrote the whole thing during the first year of the pandemic, which was hard enough. Mm. And my editor had lovely things to say about specific parts of it, but just felt like I was trying to write two different stories in one book. And that one, the story that was more interesting was the one I focused on the least. So I needed to completely reimagine the book with that story being the focus. And I started rewriting that when I was about 5 months pregnant and my brain was completely broken. And I somehow got about halfway to two thirds through the rewrite. And then I had the babies and everything was insane for 4 months. So I had a couple extensions along the way, and now I've finally gotten back into working on it, which usually happens during, I usually just try and make myself write once a day, even if it's just for a half hour. And that usually falls during one of their naps, and that's when I get it done. But it feels amazing to be working on it again. I feel very energized by writing, and it's nice to have to be able to say that I'm making progress, because up until now, anytime someone's asked how's the writing going, it's been like, it's terrible. I'm not getting anything done. So it's nice to be near the end.
Yeah, I know exactly how you feel. I'll often print out a whole draft in a manuscript form, like spiral bound, so I can just sit and flick through it and make lots of editing changes. But with the latest one, it just sat there looking at me and just kept on looking at me, and I was like, oh my God, stop looking at me,
so rude. Yeah,
I know, like they're really demanding.
It's like a weight that kind of like just sits on you, someone just sitting on your shoulder being like, have you worked on your book today?
Yeah. And then I watched a lot of videos about women in the Ukraine, and I thought, fuck it, Maureen, you have got nothing to complain about. Get that book right now. So that kind of helped inspire me along. I do feel sometimes when you have a lot of constraints in your life, it can help you be really focused, because I remember writing when my daughter was younger, and it was kind of like, I only have the time between putting her to bed and when I go to bed, which there wasn't a huge amount of time difference to that. I need to make most of the little tiny free time I have. And that was what actually spurred me on to go, no, I want to actually focus on this a lot more. So sometimes those time constraints, I think, can be very useful, but not
always. Sitting around waiting for the muse is a fool's errand a little bit. Like, some people have that luxury, and that's fantastic. And I definitely don't think that I can work on things when I just can't work on them. I mean, I had lots of time when I was pregnant. Compared to now, I was swimming in time, but my brain just wouldn't work. It wasn't that I didn't feel inspired or anything like that. I just could not get my brain to click over. So I definitely think there's something to that. But yeah, at some point you just have to sit down and do the work.
Absolutely. And I always feel like having something really, really rubbish on the page is better than having nothing on the page, because you can at least start with
and
the
sometimes
rubbish.
At least in my case, sometimes I think it's rubbish, and then when I actually look back and read it, I'm like, oh, this is actually quite good. I can
so
work
nice
with this. Because I was convinced what I wrote during the pregnancy was terrible, and then when I went back and read it, I was like, oh, this is actually readable. Like, it's actually, I can make this work.
Cool. That's so nice when that happens.
Pleasant surprise.
Yeah, it is. I think it's always why, like, as a writer, although writing's quite solitary, you still need a lot of people around you, because they need to help give you that perspective on it, and sometimes shine a light on the flaws you can't see, but also sometimes, like, reassure you that it's not as bad as you think it is as well. And I think that's a really important part of the journey with sort of agents and editors and all the other people who are sort of working behind the scenes on any book.
Absolutely, definitely.
So can you give us any hints about what's in the second book, or is it still too new?
Sure. No, that's okay. I've talked about it a little bit. So it's about a woman, it's set in Minnesota again, but this time in a small town, about a woman who returns to her small town, which she swore she would never do, to attend the funeral of her ex-boyfriend. And when she's there, she finds out that his death was under mysterious circumstances. And it seems like the pastor of the town church where she grew up has convinced his congregation to cover it up and make it look like it was an accident.
Oh, evil minister. That's
evil minister.
That's interesting. I kind of want to read that already, actually. There's something.
Me too.
I'll read it as soon as I've written it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm literally in the scene before the climax, and I still don't know how she's going to get out of it. So I'm kind of like, well, this could be fun. I have no idea how she's going to get out of this situation.
That's one of the things I find can be really fun about writing. Like, I think as writers, we often talk a lot about how tough it is to write and how tough it is to find the time to sit down and do it. And maybe we don't talk enough about how it can be really fun when you start this chapter and you're like, I know something major is going to happen, but I don't know what. I don't know how
it's just like you're typing and just like things come out. It's the most magical thing if you really think about it. Like, I will sometimes get to the end of a writing session, I'm like, I didn't plan any of that. It just happened while I was writing.
Yeah.
It's so cool.
It really is. I think everybody has different processes and how they do it, but I'm a big believer in kind of letting your subconscious do most of the heavy lifting. And to the point where sometimes as I go to bed, I'll sort of have a talk with my own subconscious and I'll be a bit like, I need to come up with an idea for this. Can you do that? And then a few days later, it'll just like randomly, I'll be washing the dishes or going for a walk or doing something. It'll just pop into my head and I'll be like, this is what you're going to do. And I'll be like, oh, amazing.
Genius. Yeah.
It's like, best. You're so clever, but I have no control over you whatsoever.
Exactly.
Yeah. But that's my process is mainly me talking to myself quite a bit. But yeah, it is fun when, like, you kind of have everything open to you and everything available to you. And I think there is a lot of excitement when you're at that point. So we're almost coming to the end of the interview, but I normally ask all my guests if they would like to recommend a book. It does not have to be crime fiction or true crime, because we've got the True Crime Fiction Bookshop and I have a little shelf of recommended. So it can be true crime or crime fiction if you want, or it might be something that just you've read and you've loved and you really want to share with people, or a palate cleanser for people who need a wee break.
Lots of options. I will say that, again, with the whole having twins thing, my reading has completely taken a hit. And I think this is actually the longest I've gone in my adult life without reading a book. It's becoming painful, but I want to wait until I've finished writing mine before I pick up another. But I will never pass up an opportunity to recommend the book Cherish Farah by Bethany C. Morrow. It just came out in February and I think is in bookstores now around the world. It is about a budding psychopathic Black teenage girl who insinuates herself in the life of her best friend and transracial adoptee in a white family's home and starts to slowly take over her life to the detriment of all involved. And it's fascinating. It's a social horror thriller. Even though it's about a teenage girl, it is distinctly adult, so don't be fooled thinking it's YA. And yeah, I just I'm still chilled thinking about that book. I got to read it while she was writing it because Bethany is a very close friend. And it's, you know, taking the world by storm. It's on all the big lists and roundups of great fiction from the start of the year. But definitely feel like everyone should read that book.
That sounds really good. So maybe a modern updated version of like Single White Female?
I think that's one of the comps for it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Single White Female meets My Sister, the Serial Killer.
Was the other one I was thinking of as
yeah.
well. I really love that book and its exploration of the relationship between the two sisters, which felt really fresh and really unusual to me. Because I think female friendship, so when I was young, female friendship was not something that really got explored. And then Sex and the City happened in the 90s and female friendship started being explored more.
Right.
But it had never really been explored in that context of covering up your sister's murders, which obviously is quite unusual in female friendships. They don't all go that way. But
I don't know. Mine are all like that. Are yours not like that?
Managed to achieve that. Yeah. No one's asked me to hide a body for them. I don't know why. I'd be really good.
I think you'd be great at it.
Thank you. Not enough people.
Yeah, you've
tell
certainly
me that.
Read enough true crime. Surely you'd have some tips.
I know. And this is the thing when you read a lot of true crime is you hold a lot of knowledge that freaks other people out. Like sometimes at work we can be having a conversation, be like, well, actually, there'll be much more women serial killers than we think. Because most women use poison, which wasn't detectable for a very long time. And people just be like, How I end so many conversations. Like people just stop talking when I say things and everyone's like, how do we move on from this?
See, like, and if I was across from you at a party and you said that, I'd be like, I'm talking to her.
And that would be great because we wouldn't be lighting up the room.
No, we wouldn't. We would be at no danger of being murdered.
Yes. We'd be very, very safe in our little creepy gothic zone.
Absolutely.
Great. I'm going to check that book out because it sounds really, really interesting. Are there any podcasts that you're really into at the moment that you'd like to recommend or were into before babies turned your world upside down?
Well, I already recommended Someone Knows Something, and Tenfold More Wicked is definitely a recommendation, even though I didn't specifically recommend it. It's wonderful, and I'm making my way through several back seasons at the moment because Kate Winkler Dawson is, I don't think she ever sleeps because she's a professor and a true crime author herself and a historian and produces multiple series of her podcasts every year. So that's a really good one. And I also just finished listening to the most recent season of Paper Ghosts. I think his name is M. William Phelps. He's a true crime author and he's done some investigation. He does kind of long form investigation in his podcast series. And that's a really interesting listen as well.
Cool. I think I generally tend to prefer long form because you can get really, really into an investigation in that way. But I also do like the ones which they're just like murder of the week. Here's half an hour of the murder because that's about the time it takes me to do my dishes.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. So is there anything, I was thinking about this last night, because last night I watched the Jimmy Savile documentary that's just been released on Netflix, which is not an easy watch for anybody, I think.
I can't imagine it would be.
Yeah, their sound production was amazing, though. They really, really brought the edgy and sinister with the sound. I was quite impressed with how they did that. So it's just two parts. It's not very long. But afterwards, I went on to see if there's been any podcasts about Jimmy Savile, and there hasn't been. There's been podcasts that do individual episodes about him, but nobody's deep dived into it. And I can understand why, because I think it's still fresh for a lot of people out there. But that had me thinking, what other things have not been covered by true crime podcasts, which maybe deserve to be covered, because they're not being talked about enough, or, you know, need a bit of time before they can be covered. Is there anything that pops to mind for you that you would like to see sort of true crime podcasting go towards more?
Oh, that's a good question. To be completely honest, I don't follow a lot of like contemporary stories in terms of serial killers or, you know, big mass murder, that type of thing. I'm much more interested in and lean much more towards now investigations of and discussions of, like I said, police violence and, you know, systemic racism, systemic oppression, and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I actually don't think there's a lot of podcasts that do a really good job of doing long form investigations. I think Serial actually did a season just in the courts. And I can't remember which city. I want to say it was Cleveland, but I don't think that's right. Where they just listened in and did recordings of like cases being brought before the court. That kind of stuff I find really fascinating. I'm watching The Wire right now, which I know I'm like 20 years behind. But that kind of thing, but as a true crime investigation, like basically just focusing in on one city, one police department, you know, what are their practices? What are they doing? What are their justifications for, you know, breaking the rules the way that they do and all of that stuff. I'm really interested in that. Yeah. And I think that that kind of thing would be really eye-opening to a lot of people, because part of the reason The Wire is so difficult for me to watch is because I know it's so accurate in terms of the way the police just bash everyone around and know that they're not going to face any consequences for it.
Yeah. So I could have a few recommendations for you on that one. So the first one would be Thunder Bay, which I've already mentioned, because that is really interesting how they pull out, and they're not just looking at the police, they're looking at the mayor, they're looking at the school system.
Yeah.
Even things as small as where people put a bridge is having an effect on the deaths of these Indigenous teens. So that's a real whole society kind of look at it. Unraveled, which is Alexis Linklater and Billy Jensen.
Yes, yeah. I do have that in my feed, but I don't think I've listened to, I think I've just listened to one season. And then didn't they do a season about like a really like awful like online troll that like ruined people's lives? I didn't feel like I could listen to that without having like massive anxiety attacks, because that kind of thing just, that just ruins my day.
that season was incredibly difficult, and that was very much a time issue. I think just that people at the time didn't understand how the internet worked and how you could stop somebody doing something on the internet like that. But it certainly made me rethink some of the information I have out there. And I did a review, and I was typing it up, and I was thinking, do I even want to use this guy's name? Because what if he searches and he finds me and he finds this review and he doesn't like it? Am I opening myself to something there? But in their first season, they do LISC, Long Island Serial Killer, but they kind of look more at the police corruption, which is popping. Like, we have police corruption here in Britain. Everybody has a certain amount of police corruption, but
there's American police corruption is a special brand.
Yeah. And if you are interested in British police corruption, Untold, the Story of the Daniel Morgan Murder might be interesting for you, which was a murder that happened in London. Daniel Morgan was a private eye, and he was found dead in a car park. He'd been hit in the head with an axe. There have been 5 investigations into his death. There ended up being a report to the Houses of Parliament, and the Home Secretary had to speak to it. And it was because what they think is he was about to go to the papers with a huge level of police corruption. And they found out and they had him killed. And it also ties in with a lot of other big scandals in British policing, like things like the Stephen Lawrence case, the News of the World phone hacking scandal. They're all wrapped up in this. And, you know, we're not having a great time with our Met Police at the moment because we had the murder of Sarah Everard, and there's been several other things that have been uncovered from that. Because it's, and I just find that really interesting because Sarah Everard was born the year Daniel Morgan was murdered, and Daniel Morgan's family still have not got justice for his murder, but that police force is still being looked at for its performance and for whether it's actually upholding and protecting people in the way it's meant to be. So when you kind of have that long lens look at it as well, it's quite stunning, and not stunning in a good way. So that one's really interesting, I think, as well. And it's still not quite been, it's not yet got to a point where it can be put to rest, basically. So those would be my three recommendations on police corruption.
I will definitely give that a listen. Sounds really interesting.
It is really good.
And infuriating.
It is as well, because there's points where you're just like, if only this had happened, or if only that person pushed this a little bit more. But it's easy with hindsight to say that kind of thing, I think, as well.
Yeah, that's true.
I have finished all my questions. Is there anything you'd like to tell listeners about where your books are being sold, where they can pick up a copy? I think we already mention you're coming out in paperback in August?
Yeah, so the hardcover is out in the US, and then the UK has I think trade paperback and mass market paperback, I think, are the two versions there. So you have the slightly smaller and less expensive version out there. I will just say in Australia and the UK, and sorry, Australia and the US, there's an audiobook where the podcast transcripts are produced like actual podcasts with narrators and that sort of thing. It's so wonderful. Cool. They've done such an incredible job with it. So if audiobooks are your bag, you might want to check those out. I think they've done the same thing in Germany and Spain. So if you speak a different language, check it out. I'm very fortunate to be published in multiple countries and multiple languages. But you can find out more on my website, asuterclark.com, and I'm asuterclark on Twitter and Instagram too, if you want to follow me.
Yeah, that'd be great. I am so envious of you having that audiobook with the actual podcast transcripts.
It's everything that I dreamed of. It's amazing.
That sounds so amazing, because in my debut, which I'm yet to get a publisher for. I have an agent, but we've not yet got a publisher. There's podcast transcripts in it as well. And that always been in my mind that would be super cool to actually have people do that podcast. It's called Scotland the Grave. And they are doing a sort of deep dive into the crimes. And it's all written from the point of view. It's called Self-Help for Serial Killers. So the killer is writing it himself as a self-help book, and he's putting these podcast transcripts in as little illustrations of, look how popular I am, they did a deep dive on me kind of thing.
That's awesome. Well, good luck. Fingers crossed.
Thank you. But I'll be so interested to hear how it's worked on your audio book as well, because that's just so cool. Well done.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, all credit to my publisher in the US and the audio publisher in Australia. They did so much good work, and you know, listened to all of my picky requirements for the different narrators and everything. It was great.
Oh, wonderful. That's so great. Well, thank you so much for taking your spare time out to talk to us today. I really appreciate that. And do keep in touch with the show and let us know when book two is coming up, because we'd love to have you back on.
Will do. Thanks so much, Mari. It was great to talk with you.
Okay. And let's bury a body together one day.
Oh, definitely. We've got to make that happen.
Okay.
You have been listening to True Crime Fiction, the podcast that is feeding your addiction to all things crime. You can find our website at true-crime-fiction.com, on Twitter at true_crime_fic, on Facebook and Instagram as True Crime Fiction. Please rate and review on the podcast app of your choice. Music is by Kitty Kitty Meow Meow.
Speaking of sleep, I'm sorry, I want to pause because I know you'll need to cut this out, but one of my babies is awake.
You want to go check on them?
Well, it's just probably going to take a while. So it's just about whether do you want me to go and come back on and we restart in like a half hour, or do you want to, I don't know how far along you are into your questions. I don't want to rush you.
What do you need to do as a mother?
Well, I appreciate that. I'm fine with leaving him for sort of another 5 to 10 minutes to cry, but he has been crying for about 10 minutes already.
Okay. Well, let's do one more question, but if he's still crying, because also I know it's like when your baby cries, you can't really focus on anything else.
It
physically tugs at you.
Yeah, so, it does.
We could try another question, but if you need, no, actually go see him. Go see him.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Do you want me to just keep this open and I'll come back when he's...
Yeah, that'll be fine. I've got stuff I can do in my living room. Okay. So I'll just take my laptop with me and just give me a shout when you're back on.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. I'll just mute myself here.
Yeah, I'll pause the recording for just now.